Welcome to the Perry Johnson Registrars Podcast, where you can expect the latest news and discussions related to the management systems certification industry. Today's episode is a previously recorded webinar. If you would like to tune in to our upcoming webinars, visit our website at www.pjr.com/webinar or give us a follow on your favorite podcast app. Thank you for tuning in.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to today's webinar. This is our very first installation in the Office Hours series, the new webinar format we're trying out. Today's session is based on IATF 16949-2016 and automotive certification. My name's Amy. I'm a member of the marketing team with the Perry Johnson Companies, and I have with me today Shannon Craddock. She's our Programs and Accreditation Manager and an IATF 16949 Lead Auditor. Shannon, welcome to the webinar, and thanks for being here.
Thanks, Amy, for having me do this. I'm really excited about this series. One of the best parts of our webinars are the Q&A, and this really is going to have a Q&A slant to it, a chance for folks to ask questions or listen to questions and answers and hopefully learn something today.
Yeah, absolutely. I know you came up with this idea a couple of weeks ago, and we were very excited to try something new. So why don't you go over what our goals are for today?
Great, thank you. So Perry Johnson Office Hours is going to be a regularly occurring series on a variety of topics, so not just IATF. So in the coming months, we'll do one on R2v3, we'll do one on root cause and corrective action, which is actually one of our most popular webinars. Other topics may include RIOS 14001, 45001, the new aerospace standards, AS9104-1, the new AS9101. The format is going to be mostly questions and answers. Some folks went ahead and emailed us questions in advance. And feel free to tap in questions into the chat feature, and I'll get those answers. We're not going to do a lot of talking head lecture format today. Amy will be reading questions that were previously emailed or those that you write in, and I'll be able to answer these questions or any questions related to the accredited certification process. So nothing is off limits, even though we're trying to slant this towards IATF 16949. And based on today's audience, I expect that's what most of the questions will relate to. I may not know all the answers, and I'll be very honest if I don't know the answer and need to research it, and we'll get back with all the participants via email or some sort of communication once I'm able to research the answer. This presentation is being recorded, and it will be available for download at pjr.com within about 48 hours from the end of today's broadcast.
That's completely correct, Shannon. And as Shannon said, we do absolutely want to take all the questions you have, whether they're IATF related or just a general automotive certification question, or even just about PJR certification process in general. And as Shannon mentioned, you can send those questions to us live, and we will take those as we go through the slides rather than waiting till the end as we traditionally do during our webinars. So on the control panel on your screen, you can just open the questions tab or the chat feature and just send us your questions. There should be a field to type them in, and we'll get those and answer them as we are able to. But just to get us started, Shannon, so all of these questions were sent in by people prior to our broadcast. So thank you to everyone who sent in questions, and thank you in advance to anyone who asks questions throughout the session. But the first question is, why do I have to provide so much performance data in advance of the audit? It's a lot of work.
Great question. So I agree. It is a lot of work to prepare for an upcoming audit. So the main reason that we have you send in performance data in advance of the audit is because it's a requirement of Rules 5th edition. So if you're certified to IATF 16949, or you're looking to become certified, when you purchase the standard, I would encourage you to purchase a copy of Rules 5th edition. In that document, it lays out a requirement for clients to send in performance data in advance of the audit. Performance data means customer scorecard data, customer complaints, internal audit and management review results, internal KPI data, and the latest copy of your quality manual and any required procedures. And in terms of the time period, we're looking for about 12 months worth of data. So this is quite a retrospective analysis that our auditor is doing, but we want to go back till the prior audit. The auditor will analyze this information and use that to compile the most strategic audit plan. So if the auditor sees you're struggling in a particular area, maybe based on internal audit results or some themes that they're seeing in customer feedback and customer complaints, they may slant the audit plan that way. Okay, Amy, next question.
All righty then. Moving right along, what is the point of the extra hour before the opening meeting? Does it really serve a purpose, or is it just to give people extra grace period to make it on time?
This question, Amy, really relates to the first question. So the auditor received all that pre-planning information in advance of the audit in order to compile the most strategic audit plan. Sometimes clients submit this information 60, 90 days in advance of the audit. So there might be some new data that our auditor hasn't seen yet. So in this extra hour, the customer will be required to access the latest version of customer scorecards in real time. So if scorecards are available in a customer portal, the auditor will need to see the client open those customer portals, log in, and pull down the latest version of the scorecard. And it may be that the data haven't changed and our auditor has the latest revision, but there may be a new release or a refresh of those data. You may have some new internal performance data. You may have added a month or two onto that, and we may see some trends that we need to investigate there. You may have completed more on your internal audit schedule or had an additional management review since the data required by question one were first submitted. I do want to caution you, however, if you are not able to access any customer portals during this extra hour, so you want to make sure that all relevant personnel are available in this extra hour, that's an automatic major nonconformity. So the IETF has directed our auditors to write a major nonconformity if our auditors can't see you access the latest version of the customer portals and pull down those scorecards. After reviewing these data, our auditors may make some last minute adjustments to the audit plan and get that to you. So it's really a chance for the auditor to make sure they have the latest and greatest data and they finalize the audit plan and make sure that it's as strategic as possible for the upcoming audit event.
Great. We did have a question come in that I'm going to toss right into the mix here. Looks like this one is specific to the IETF standard, namely 71511. And the question is, are MSA studies required for every single instrument or device?
That's a great question. So MSA studies are required for every type of device that's listed on a control plan. So if you're using micrometers or calipers, for example, you don't have to test every mic or caliper, just one gauge from the family of the device. It's important that you're following the method prescribed in the MSA manual or whatever other customer designated method is used, and make sure that the participants in that study are the folks that are actually doing the measurements. So if operators on the shop floor are actually doing the measurements, they should be the intended audience of your study. If people in the QA lab are doing the measurements, then they should be participating in the study.
All right, great. Thank you to the person who sent that question. And as I said before, keep the questions coming. We'll throw in the ones we receive as we get them, in addition to the ones that we received in advance. But moving on to the third question that we had received before the broadcast, how can people get help with replying to nonconformities in CARA? I know we have a webinar from Joe Krolikowski on this topic. Do you have anything to add to this?
Yes, yeah, so CARA is the new common audit report template that's used by all IATF auditors. So at the conclusion of your audit, you'll get a number of files. If the auditor has completed the report in its entirety, you'll get the final audit report in a JSON format and a PDF format. If the auditor did not have time to finish their report, you'll get a draft report, which will include the nonconformities. And then within 15 business days, you'll get a final report and then a report with the nonconformities. You'll need to load that JSON file into CARA in order to answer the nonconformities. You can upload any attachments there as well. It's a little challenging the first time you do it. I struggled with CARA the first time I used it. I don't do a lot of IETF audits because I'm doing more program management work in the office. And there's always a little bit of a learning curve for me, Amy. Similarly, I expect that clients will get comfortable with it right after each audit, and then a year later have to go through some type of learning curve. We do have, as you mentioned, that webinar from Joe Krolikowski, and it will walk you through step-by-step how to load the JSON file into CARA and answer the nonconformities. We can send you that tutorial via email. So don't be afraid to request it from our office.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know we recently did an instance of the CARA webinar with Joe. He presents that usually at least once a year, usually every 6 months. We don't currently have one on the schedule, but if there's interest and someone wants to see it live so they can ask questions of Joe, certainly let us know and we can see if he can get a session of that on the books. Otherwise, the recordings of the past sessions are available for review free on our YouTube channel. All right. Speaking of scorecards, going back to that topic, how do I know what scorecard information auditors will want to review?
This is great. So I want to answer this question in two ways. So if you have a smaller, lower tier automotive customer, typically those customers will send you scorecards. Perhaps you'll download it from a portal, but most likely they'll email you scorecards that will indicate quality performance and delivery performance. Perhaps there'll be a responsiveness or cooperation score. Those are fairly straightforward because those are sent to you. Some of the IATF subscribing OEMs will require you to download scorecards from the customer portal. Amy, could you give me control? I want to share a website that may help some of our participants.
Absolutely, give me just one second. All right, you should be the presenter now, Shannon.
Excellent. Okay, Amy, so I'm at the website IATFGlobalOversight.org. And this is a really handy website. So if you're wondering what our auditors are going to look at regarding IATF OEM subscribing customer scorecards, I'd encourage you to check this feature out here. So under this dashboard, you'll see a section called OEM Requirements. Click on Quick Reference Guides. And you'll see here, for example, Ford Motor Company screen images, General Motors, you'll see scorecard screen images, Stellantis, scorecard screen images. So these are the tools that our auditors use. And I just clicked on Stellantis here. These are the tools that our auditors use to make sure that they're looking at the correct scorecards. So we expect you to log in at eSupplier Connect, select the appropriate region, click on the link for the global EBSC or external balance scorecard, This is what it'll look like. This is what we want to see. And this is what you should be sending us in advance of the audit as well. We're looking at operational metrics. They caution us to review only IMQ, warranty, and delivery. We're not, as auditors, concerned with cost. We want to look at the single month view and the last 6 months year to date view, and then the detail reports. And if we look at, for example, General Motors, guidance here on how we expect the supplier to log in or the auditee to log in. We want to look at the BIQS. We want to look at SPPSs. We're very concerned with the BIQS level. We're looking at the impact detail report. We're looking at the type. Looking at things, looking at some of the SPPSs. So that's just some detail, Amy, on what our auditors are looking for. So for ITF OEM subscribing customers, I'd encourage you to visit the IETF Global Oversight website. Again, click on OEM requirements and the quick reference guides. These are what our auditors use. They're reference guides for our auditors in terms of how we should be auditing scorecards. And I think it's really important information for our customers to know so that they can be prepared.
Absolutely. That looks like a great resource.
And one other point I want to make, Amy, under OEM requirements, you can also access the latest version of all the customer-specific requirements. So you can see here from BMW, Ford, Geely Group, one of the newest IETF OEM subscribing customers, Mercedes-Benz, Renault, you can see all of those and access the latest versions there. All right, next question.
Thanks for sharing. We actually got a question from our audience, so I will take care of that one before we jump back onto the slides. John is wondering if you could please explain BIQ.
BIQ?
Yeah, John, if you want to extrapolate, just you can go ahead and pop into the chat or back into the question box and explain what your the more specific question that you have.
Wondering perhaps, John, if he means BIQS?
Yes, he has confirmed he does mean BIQS.
Okay. So BIQS is used by General Motors. It's essentially a supplier score. We get concerned when that supplier score falls below a certain level and the supplier turns red. We are automatically alerted when that happens. So typically you'll get a number of SPPSs in a time period that will turn that BIQS indicator to red. And once you trip that trigger or trip that threshold, you'll turn red. Your certification body will be automatically notified and we'll have to do a deep dive analysis into why this has happened and make a decision about whether or not we'll be suspending your certificate. I hope that answers your question, John.
Thanks, Shannon. Yeah, John, if you have any further questions or want some more detail, please feel free to ask. I'm going to jump over to the fifth question that we had also received before the broadcast. And I know this is a common question with any webinar we give. What are some of the common NCRs specific to IETF?
This is a great question, Amy, and I've got a lot of insight that I'd like to share with organizations that are participating today. So these are NCRs that I find myself writing as an IETF auditor, but also when I'm doing IETF database entry, I'm privy to the results of other auditors as well, Amy. So I've got a lot of insight. So a common finding that we see is against second party audits, which is 84241. So there's a requirement for organizations to do second party audits in their supplier development process. And you can implement this requirement any way you want. You can do it when you're bringing on a new supplier. You can go and conduct a second party audit. Maybe you have a supplier to whom you've issued a lot of SCARs or they appear to be struggling. You can go and conduct a second party audit. I think the best use of second party audit resources would obviously be based on risk. So you're bringing on a new supplier for a brand new product line, a complicated product line, a high risk product line. Might be a great time to dedicate some resources and meet that second party audit requirement. Maybe you have a supplier that's really struggling, another great application. Keep in mind that the standard has some very specific requirements in terms of competency for second party auditors. And those can be found, I've got to consult my standard here, in 724. So there's a lot of very specific requirements for second party auditors. So make sure your auditor who's performing a second party audit in accordance with 84241 meets the competency requirements that are in a different part of the standard, 724. So that's a common NCR. I also write a lot of NCRs, Amy, on 8511, which is control plans. So it's fascinating to me that every single third-party auditor at the start of the audit of a manufacturing process will ask for a copy of the control plan. And all we're doing is walking the control plan during the audit. So if it says that you do incoming inspection and it's done in a certain way and you're checking every box, if it says that once you're in, if you're in machine setup and you should be doing a test of the error-proofing equipment and you need to run a red rabbit and you're not doing that, well, that's a concern. So we're walking the control plan in our audit of the manufacturing process. We see a lot of issues with inaccuracies in the control plan, and that's going to lead to a finding against 8511. So when you're doing your own internal audits, you need to be walking the control plan. It's very easy to see, are they doing it exactly as prescribed in line 10 and line 20 and line 30 is appropriate. If I'm seeing a lot of issues with the control plan, not only am I going to write a finding against 8511, but I may write a finding about the effectiveness of your manufacturing process audits. Because in your manufacturing process audits, you need to be walking the control plan. So that may lead to a finding against, and I've got to look this up here, I don't know this requirement by heart, 9223. So if you're not walking the control plan, I may be writing a finding against 9223, effectiveness of the manufacturing process audits. We also write a lot of findings against contingency planning, 6123. The IETF has a very specific requirement about a backup power supply. So this could be a generator, this could be safety stock, this can be arrangements with a generator company, a contract with a company to provide a generator, safety stock arrangements with alternate manufacturing facilities. That needs to be clearly detailed in your contingency plan. And then to a lesser degree, we often will write findings against 7511D, which is the matrix to show how your processes in your management system meet the requirements of the IETF standard and any customer-specific requirements. So we often see that the customer-specific requirements are missing from that matrix. So again, the heavy hitters, not doing second-party audits, 84241. Perhaps you're doing them, but your auditor is not meeting 724. the competency requirements for second-party auditors. A lot of findings. This is probably the biggest one against control plans being inaccurate, 8511, that document not matching what's physically happening in the facility. And then if I see a lot of control plan issues, I'm really going to question the effectiveness of your manufacturing process audits. And that's 923. I'm going to say, why am I catching all of this and you're not catching this? Are you really walking the control plan in your manufacturing process audit? 6123, contingency planning as it relates to backup power. And 7511D, that matrix not addressing customer specific requirements. Thanks, Amy. Amy?
Can you hear me?
Okay, now I can hear you.
There we go. Sorry about that. Thanks for the response, Shannon. And I thought it was great that you mentioned processes several times in your answer. We've gotten a question here about the documentation of processes. Specifically, does every single individual process need to be broken out into its own documented process, or can they possibly be grouped together?
So grouping is allowed. And not every process needs to be a documented process. So when you look at the standard, in some cases it'll say process, and in some cases it'll say documented process. If you have maybe a combo procedure for internal audits and corrective action, that's fine. It can be one documented process. So clubbing or grouping is certainly allowed. Additionally, that documentation can be words, it can be flowcharts, it can look a lot of different ways. There's no prescribed methodology.
All right, great. Hopefully that answers that question thoroughly. Again, if anyone needs some more detail on anything, please just let us know and we're happy to go more in depth. But moving on to question six, what are the SIs and FAQs and where can I access them?
Great question. And Amy, if you'd make me the presenter again, I want to pull up IETF Global Oversight again.
All right, go for it, Shannon.
Okay, so I'm back at IETFGlobalOversight.org. And in the dashboard across the top, you see there's a dropdown for IETF 16949-2016. And you can access frequently asked questions and sanction interpretations about the IETF standard itself. So let's just select the sanction interpretations. And then there's a drop down for language. And you can see here that there's a number of sanctioned interpretations. Sanction interpretations 23 through 25 were issued in May and were made effective in June of this year. So you can see that there's a number of SIs regarding clarification, changes to the standard. So contingency plans here in sanction interpretation 3 talks about that your contingency plans must periodically test cybersecurity threats. Cybersecurity testing can be managed by the organization or subcontracted to a third party. I also see a lot of companies not including cybersecurity in their contingency plans, Amy. So there's a number of clarifications, clarification on internal auditor competency. And it's important to note that all of these sanction interpretations provide clarification or changes to the standard, and these are all normative. So they're subject to audit during your third-party audit by PJR. Rules 5th edition, which is the rules of engagement for the automotive scheme. They also have frequently asked questions and assigns. The latest one was issued April 2022, provides clarification on common scenarios. So what happens if a certified site changes its name, what happens if a certified site moves? Can customers observe a third-party audit? Some of these questions are specific to certification bodies. This one really has come as a result of COVID, poor OEM scorecard performance caused by a semiconductor chip shortage, how that's handled. So you can get clarification through FAQs or SIs for both the standard and the rules, fifth edition. What's next, Amy?
We actually have a question here from Howard. Howard says, there's a lot in the ITF standard for machining and automated processes. How does this apply to assembly and manual processes?
How does the standard apply to assembly and manual processes?
Yeah, Howard, if you'd like to clarify, we'd love to answer your question.
So the standard, I'll provide an answer at a high level, Amy, and then if Howard types in any clarification, I can provide clarification. So the standard is applicable to any site that does automotive manufacturing. So that can include automated processes, manual processes, or assembly processes. The point is they're making something, they're producing something that goes on a car. Supporting locations, maybe those providing warehousing or design services or maybe a customer service center, those cannot be certified to IATF by themselves, only as they support a manufacturing site. Then they go along for the ride and are included in the scope of certification.
All right. Yeah, Howard, if you wanted something more specific, all right. It looks like Howard has said it's regarding the points where setups were discussed, that his organization does not do a lot of setups. They also support on highway trucking.
Okay, so on highway trucking is certainly IATF applicable. So it appears that you may not have a lot of processes that are automated or have error proofing built in. So you may be missing some of those steps from your control plan as they would not be applicable. And that's perfectly fine. And again, if I'm missing the point of your question, feel free to type in further clarification. Okay, question 7, the most common pitfalls regarding internal audits. So what I see regarding internal audits are auditors not meeting competency requirements for conducting internal audits. So these are defined in section 723 of the standard. So this is quite a long section. So your management system auditors need to be competent in the automotive process approach for auditing, applicable CSRs. For example, if you supply to GM, they really need to understand the GM customer specific requirements. They need to understand the IATF and 9001 standards, the core tools, if applicable to the scope of the audit. So if they're auditing calibration or the quality lab, and understanding how to effectively record audit evidence, compile an audit report, write nonconformities, and close them out. Auditors doing manufacturing process audits really need to understand the manufacturing process audits, the control plan, the FEMA, and the process flow. And auditors doing product audits need to understand the product requirements and specifications, and any relevant inspection, measuring, and test equipment used. So competency is a big thing. So make sure your auditors meet the requirements of 723. Additionally, some customers, Ford in particular, have very specific competency requirements for internal auditors. Again, this relates to one of the earlier questions, but make sure that when you're doing a manufacturing process audit, if your manufacturing process auditor is not walking around with a control plan, don't bother. It's the only way to do a manufacturing process audit or an LPA. If you're doing LPAs, part of that process means the auditor is walking around with a copy of the control plan. And then making sure that you're really auditing with the automotive process approach in mind. What does this mean? You need to make sure the process owner understands the inputs and outputs of the process, what the key performance indicator is, whether or not that process is currently meeting the key performance indicator. And if it isn't, what are they doing to get to where they want to be?
All right, it looks like we had an input. I'm not sure if it was just a general remark or if it's a question from John, just saying internal auditors need to be certified. So I'm not sure if that's meant to be a question about the qualifications of internal auditors. John, if you wanted to clarify, that would be appreciated.
I think I can take this one, Amy. There's no requirement that internal auditors need to take a particular certified or accredited course. So that's a fallacy. Internal auditors need to be competent, and there's a lot of different ways to gain competence. One of them may certainly be a very particular certified course, but it's not the only way.
All right. I hope that answered your question, John. Let us know if you want some more information on that. All right. John has clarified that he once had a finding that he was not certified in reference to internal audits. Any insight, Shannon?
Yeah, I'd have to get more information from John, specifically his company name and who his auditor was. And I'd want to look at that finding. I would hope that if it was a PJR auditor, that we wouldn't have written that up. That's not an appropriate finding, and it most certainly should have been disputed. But John, I can help you offline. And if PJR is your certification body, I can certainly address it. If we're not your certification body, certainly take it up with them. There's no requirement that auditors need to have a very particular or certain type of certification. They just need to meet the competency requirements outlined in the standard.
All right. Thank you for that, Shannon. And yeah, John, I would encourage you, if PJR is your certification body, to reach out so that we can make this more clear for you. And speaking of, you know, nonconformities and findings, what happens when a major nonconformity is documented? Can it be appealed?
Yeah. So if a major nonconformity is documented, from PJR's perspective, we require the auditor to take a number of steps. So if a client's already certified, a major nonconformity is a big deal, because whenever an auditor writes a major nonconformity on an audit, the certificate is automatically suspended. And that suspension is reflected in the IETF database, Amy, and that's visible to the IETF OEM subscribing customers. We don't take this lightly. So if an auditor thinks that they have clear evidence that a major finding exists, and again, the IETF standard defines a major nonconformity as a complete breakdown or a likelihood that suspect or nonconforming product could be shipped, a major needs to be documented. PJR actually requires its auditors to call the office and speak with a technical expert, typically myself or Joe Krolikowski, in our office and discuss the finding and make sure that they seem to be on the right track and that they get some concurrence for us before we take that leap. Certainly, there may be times when organizations don't agree with the lead auditor's conclusion and they can appeal that classification. And this is done by filing an appeal with our office. So what you want to do is ask for a copy of our Pro 10, which is our official appeal procedure that'll walk you through the process. We have one staff member, Ms. Robbie Milligan, who is responsible for the appeal process, and she'll walk you through that process. Robbie does an excellent job of maintaining her KPI for this process, making sure that appeals are heard quickly and you receive a detailed description of the appeal panel's decision at the end of the appeal. It's typically a hearing conducted by remote means. As the appellant, you'll have a chance to present your side of the story. The lead auditor will have a chance to present their side of the story. There'll be a portion of time for Q&A, and then the appeal panel will dispute and render a decision. But you absolutely have the right to appeal.
Thanks for that, Shannon. I know another resource that I can personally offer anyone who has more questions about this. We do have a white paper available for free download on our website. If you go to pgr.com under the training tab, you'll find a link to our white paper library. It's titled The Dispute Process, and it just goes into more detail outlining how exactly to appeal a major or minor that you disagree with. All right. Moving on to question number 9, what are the deadlines for corrective actions in IATF? Are there any grace periods or, you know, outstanding allowances for certain circumstances?
Sure. So if there's a major nonconformity within 20 days of the closing meeting, you need to submit evidence of correction or containment and a root cause analysis. By the 60-day mark for both majors and minors, we need the full corrective action, including evidence of implementation and your own verification. Our auditor then gets an additional 30 days, so we're now 90 days after the last day of the audit, to review your response and kick it back to you. Sometimes there's a period of back and forth and rework between the client and the lead auditor, until the lead auditor feels the response is acceptable. By day 91, after the closing meeting, our auditor submits the approved nonconformities and corrective actions to our office, and our veto power has to review and accept those by day 120. Not really a lot of grace period on this, because all of these milestones are entered into the IETF database. We can have a little bit of wiggle room, I'm talking a few days, but not much more than that. Where there is some flexibility, Amy, it would depend on the type of finding that the auditor wrote and the corrective action that makes sense. So some corrections certainly will take more than 60 days to implement and verify. So perhaps you have to do a number of gauge studies over, and it can't physically be done in 60 days. Maybe a corrective action includes a capital expenditure or adding an annex to a building. That's an extreme example, but I've seen it before. So what we can do is accept a plan for corrective action if the corrective action is really a longer term corrective action that couldn't feasibly done in 60 days. We'll classify the finding as 100% resolved. And then if you told us that the deadline and that everything would be implemented 6 months later, very shortly after that 6 month mark, we would do a special audit to verify that in fact everything was done when you said it was going to be done. And if we were in a situation where we saw things weren't implemented, it would lead to a certificate suspension. So that 100% resolved classification is available for longer term corrective actions that couldn't possibly be implemented in 60 days. Now, for things like revising a procedure and retraining 3 quality assurance inspectors, that definitely can be done in 60 days. That 100% resolved classification would not be applicable in that scenario.
All right, thanks, Shannon. Next question that we had from before the broadcast. Are there any revisions planned for the standard, or what about the rules 5th edition?
Yeah, this is a great question. And PGR belongs to a group called the IACBA, the International Association of the International Automotive Certification Body Association. And Joe Kerlikowske recently attended their periodic meeting. The standard itself is going to get revised beginning in 2023. The change is only going to be in the IETF requirements. So the 9001 requirements will remain the same. And the Rules 5th edition is currently already in revision to Rules 6th. And CBs are going to get their first chance to review the draft version of Rules 6th edition in quarter four of this year.
All right, that's something to look forward to then. All right, next question up. What is the IETF's perspective on remote and virtual audits after the pandemic? You know, less and less facilities are having no visitor rules and other things to interfere. What does it look like for the future?
Yeah, so unless the reason is rooted in COVID, the IETF is saying no to remote or virtual audits, especially of manufacturing sites. So if the reason is related to COVID, there's been a number of COVID cases, you have a no visitor policy, one of the audit contacts has a compromised immune system, the auditor used for this particular series of audits at a company is in an area where they can't travel, perhaps they're in China and they can't leave at this point in time, a remote audit would be possible. But if it's a remote audit just for the sake of doing a remote audit, that is not allowed. As we get further and further away from some of the COVID surges, and Amy, I really hope that's happening, and the pandemic becomes more endemic, I think we're going to see that most manufacturing audits are on site. But Rule 6 edition may include some provisions for the audits of remote supporting locations to be conducted remotely. But only time will tell. We'll have to see what Rule 6 edition includes.
Yeah, definitely. And I know we've already mentioned Joe Kerlikowske's CARA webinar. He's also done several on virtual audits and the policies surrounding those. So, you know, as things change, I'm sure he'll update the contents of that webinar for future instances. So stay tuned for those if you have more questions. It looks like we have a question here that's similar to, somewhat related to what we were talking about before with the dispute process. This one's from Lisa. Lisa's saying we had a bad experience with an auditor at a previous CB. What does PGR do about, you know, poor experiences with auditors? What can be done?
That's a great question. So Lisa, if you have a bad experience with an auditor, I would encourage you to file a complaint with the certification body. IETF 16949 is one of the few standards where if auditors do certain things, the certification body is required to report them to their oversight office. So in PGR's case, our oversight office is the IAOB in Southfield, Michigan. There's an oversight office in the UK, in France, Italy, and Germany as well. And all certification bodies are assigned to one of those oversight offices. So if an auditor does not meet certain codes of conduct, the CB is required to report them. But that process starts with you, Lisa. Make sure you file a complaint with the certification body, and then they're forced to go through a decision tree about whether or not that complaint needs to get elevated to the oversight office. This may lead to an auditor losing their credentials, which may be appropriate depending on what it was that the auditor did. So acting inappropriately, threatening the client, allowing certain things to happen would certainly be inappropriate. If the auditor was being tough or rigorous and the audit was fair, but the outcome just isn't what you liked, likely not a reason that we would have to report that auditor to the oversight office, but I'd encourage you to always file a complaint with the CB, and then that will force them to go through that exercise. We don't want bad auditors in this scheme. Folks pay a lot of money for certification audits, and you deserve a fair and rigorous audit.
Absolutely. And on the flip side of that, Shannon, if a client has a great experience with an auditor, would they be able to, depending on availability, request the same auditor for their next audit?
Yeah, so in fact, IETF has a very specific rule that there has to be continuity in the auditor for the entire audit cycle. So if I audited a client under stage one and stage two, I would have to do their first and second annual surveillance. I can also do their recertification audit, Amy, but it has to be as a team member, and I can usher in a new lead auditor who will continue with that client from the recertification and the next two surveillance audits. There has to be auditor change out every cycle.
All right.
We
Well,
don't want
hopefully.
the,
Oh, go ahead. Sorry, Shannon.
sorry, we don't want the auditors becoming too close. Always want a fresh set of eyes in there.
All right, great. Thank you, Shannon. And Lisa, if you had any more questions regarding auditor credentials, reporting auditors, please feel free to reach out some more. All right, this is our last question that we had from before the broadcast. The question is, we have a design center supporting four different sites. Does it have to be audited four separate times?
Oh, this is a great question, Amy. So we do see the scenario often at PJR. So we'll have four manufacturing sites that may be certified separately as single sites as opposed to a corporate scheme. And then there's a single design center that supports each of those manufacturing sites. Sometimes those four different manufacturing sites are all certified by PJR, but sometimes only a couple of them are, and other certification bodies may be involved as well. So it's important to communicate with your certification body in advance of any audit activity taking place and say, hey, our manufacturing sites are going to get audited at different points in time. We only want you to do one audit at the design center. We don't want these people audited four times. Here are all the manufacturing sites this design center supports. Please make sure that your lead auditor samples design projects relevant to all four sites. That way, when an auditor is auditing the manufacturing site, they can consult that audit report and we don't have to continually re-audit the site. Organizations need to clearly communicate to their certification body all the sites that that design center supports so that we can make sure we're sampling design projects relevant to all sites. This is especially important if more than one certification body is involved. So, if, for example, certification body X is auditing the design center and PJR is auditing two of the four sites, they need to tell certification body X, hey, there's two sites that you may not know about. Here are their locations. Please make sure your auditor samples projects relative to those sites that are audited by PJR. You will then have to provide a copy of that design center's audit report to PJR in the auditor's native language. You're also going to want to make sure that that audit is in fact conducted to IETF 16949. A lot of times clients try to pass off a 9001 audit report, which is not appropriate. We need that design center to be audited to IETF 16949. So communication is key, and communication in advance.
All right. Well, I think that just about does it for what we had prepared, that we had received in advance. If anyone has any other questions they'd like Shannon to discuss, we've got about 7 minutes left in our scheduled time. Please send those in ASAP so we can get those taken care of for you. But I will encourage everyone to visit pjr.com, check out our other upcoming webinars at pjr.com/webinars. There's also a link on our website to the slides where you can download any of the slides from our past webinars just to have on hand to distribute to your coworkers, your team, anyone who might be interested. And we also have available all the recordings, including all the voiceovers and Q&A sessions from our previous webinars. Those are on our YouTube channel. There's a link to our YouTube channel on our website at pjr.com, or you can simply go to YouTube and search up for Perry Johnson Registrars. It should be among the first few results. But Shannon, just once again, I want to say thank you for joining us and for coming up with this great concept for a new webinar series. We hope that everyone found it very informative.
I hope so too, Amy. And as you've been talking, and I've had a little bit of a break here, I've been scrolling through some of the questions that were asked. And I think I can provide additional clarification on John's question. He indicated that he took a 5-day class to become an internal certified auditor, and he was written up for this. So the only thing that I could possibly think of, John, is that perhaps that was the only evidence competency record or evidence of competency presented to your third party auditor. And remember, there are a lot of other competency requirements that you need to meet. Perhaps that course didn't cover the core tools or customer specific requirements. If it did not, there might be some gaps in competency that you might have to address above and beyond that class. But Amy, thank you for facilitating today. It's great to have some interaction, and I appreciate you fielding all these emails that we received and compiling them for today's office hours. And I hope I get invited to participate again on a different topic.
Shannon, you're one of our brightest and best at PGR. I am sure you will be involved in at least one, if not several, future sessions. If any of our attendees have a specific topic in mind, you know, maybe you're involved with more than just IATF certification, please do reach out to us if you have suggestions for other future office hours topics that you'd like to see. You know, we do have the floor open to any certification-related question during these, but if you'd like to see something more specific, do let us know. We're always open to suggestions for new and exciting webinars like this. But I'm going to wrap things up here since we're just about out of time. And I'm going to say thank you to our audience today and for everyone, especially who sent in questions both before and during the broadcast. It's always a great time to have some, as Shannon said, some extra interaction with the people who want and need these webinars. So look forward to seeing the recording of this posted up on our YouTube channel, as well as the slides will be on our website. And we hope to see you on the next session. Shannon, thank you again, and I hope everyone has a great day.
Thanks, Amy. Take care, everyone. Stay safe.